Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Brian Reynolds, registration number 29493. Members of the court, we're here today because on September 26, 2013, the Denver District Court issued an order in this case. That order is wrong for three reasons. First, the District Court failed to apply the long-established standard of review in a 106 action. Secondly, the District Court engaged in impermissible fact-finding. And third, the court relied on its own interpretation of a video to the exclusion of other competent evidence in the record. This incident goes back to July 12, 2009. It involves a Denver police officer by the name of Ricky Nixon. And the incident started down at the Denver Diner, which is just a few blocks down the street from us right now at Colfax and Spear. On that night, Officer Nixon was working in an off-duty capacity of security, and he was alerted to a fight at the restaurant. He took police action, and he handcuffed one of the suspects and took her outside. And that's where this case, this appeal, really picks up. Because it's at that point in time when Officer Nixon gets the suspect outside, he's surrounded by a couple of the suspect's friends, and Officer Nixon is concerned enough that he calls on his radio for cover officers to arrive, to come to his assistance. And he does what's called a code 10 call. He pushes an emergency button on his microphone, and he calls out that he needs help. And code 10 means that officers are supposed to respond immediately via lights and siren. When Officer Nixon makes that call, another thing happens, that the Denver Police Department is able to take over certain cameras in the downtown area. They're called HALO cameras, high activity location observation cameras. When Officer Nixon made his emergency call, that's what happened, and that's part of the evidence in this case, is the HALO video. As a result of the Denver Diner incident, there was an investigation by Internal Affairs. That investigation lasted for over 2.5 years, and ultimately Officer Nixon was disciplined for a variety of things. The city charter for the city and county of Denver provides for civil servants to have protections under the Civil Service Commission. And that's important because as police officers, officers give up certain rights when they decide to become civil servants, and they're entitled to certain protections under the law as civil servants. For instance, officers can't strike, they can't organize and strike, or even have the blue flu, an informal type activity. In exchange, they're protected by the Denver Charter, which says all disciplinary actions shall be reviewed by the Denver Civil Service Commission. In this instance, Officer Nixon did exactly that. He appealed his discipline to the Denver Civil Service Commission, and a charter of the commission also provides that that appeal, in this case, would be heard by three hearing officers. In 2012, those hearing officers held a four-day hearing on the issue of Officer Nixon's discipline. The key issue at that trial was whether Officer Nixon committed a deceptive act. Committed a deceptive act in violation of Denver Police Department Rule 112.2. To make that decision, those hearing officers heard testimony from 11 witnesses. They accepted 44 exhibits into evidence, and they reviewed the HALO video in great detail with several of the witnesses who explained their perception of events at the time. Those three hearing officers are each trained lawyers, and they were each selected by the City and County of Denver to serve as objective, non-biased hearing officers.
Mr. Reynolds, let me ask you a question about that. As you know, we're supposed to give deference to the findings of the hearing officers, yet the Civil Service Commission criticized part of the hearing officer's opinion because it felt that the hearing officers were unduly critical of the manager of safety. How does that weigh into our consideration of the findings of fact of the hearing officers?
I think they're two separate issues there, Judge. I do believe, and I agree with you, that the commission was critical of the hearing officers for certain comments they made in dicta. Those comments, though, went to the credibility of one of the witnesses for the city. One of the witnesses for the city got up on the stand and he testified. He testified essentially, he couldn't remember the underlying facts. He testified inaccurately that the officers, their actions caused dismissals of criminal complaints against the suspects in this case. That was completely untrue. I believe what the officers were doing was making a statement about the credibility of the witness and not about that witness's authority to take certain actions one way or the other.
Okay.
Did that address, you. I'm not sure if I addressed that or...
Yes, I think you did. Thank you.
Okay. Excuse me, counsel. Sure. I want to make sure we get a chance to talk about ultimate issues of fact.
Yes, Judge.
And because that's really what this turns on. That's what Judge Starrs was looking at and why she reversed the decision. There is plenty of law that indicates that ultimate issues of fact are not binding on the reviewing body, correct? So let's talk, if we can, about the law regarding that. Particularly, I'd like to have you address Lawley versus Department of Higher Education. It's a Colorado Supreme Court case from 2001. In that instance, there's some similarities to this case. That was one where the evidence, the hearing officers had concluded that there was no evidence that there was intent to discriminate against a person based on gender. And then when it got to, if that came up to the Court of Appeals, the Court of Appeals said there was no evidence in the record that the person was discriminated against because of her gender. And the Supreme Court said that it's an ultimate issue of fact whether there was an intent to discriminate or not. It seems to me that there's some parallels between that case and this case, because isn't it an ultimate issue of fact of whether there was an intent to deceive or knowing deception here? Can you please address that?
Yes, Your Honor. I agree. The ultimate conclusion of fact in this case is the question, did Officer Nixon commit a deceptive act that was material to the investigation, and three, with the required intent, knowingly, willfully, or intentionally.
Okay, assuming that that's an ultimate issue of fact then, the Civil Service Commission was not then bound with regard to that ultimate issue of fact by the findings of the hearing panel. Is that correct?
I agree, but there is a question precedent to these ultimate issue. That ultimate issue has three questions. First, whether there was a deceptive act, whether it was material, and then whether it had the met this required subjective mental intent. What the hearing officers...
Well, hang on, isn't whether there was a deceptive act, isn't that an ultimate issue of fact?
I do not agree that it was.
Well, but if that's the statement under... The law about what's an ultimate issue of fact is whether it's stated in terms of the statute or the rule.
Correct.
And so the determination of whether there was an ultimate, a deceptive act, that's the ultimate determination. So why isn't that the ultimate determination?
That, I don't believe that is the ultimate determination. The ultimate determination is the application of the factual finding that there was a deceptive act, period. Then the analysis for whether, as far as the ultimate conclusion, the legal analysis is deceptive act, plus it has to be material, plus the required subjective intent or mens rea. What the hearing officers found, they made factual findings throughout their order that in every instance alleged, Officer Nixon did not commit a deceptive act. That's a factual question. That's the first element of the ultimate question, deceptive act, mens rea, plus materiality.
Well, I'm having difficulty agreeing with you on that, because the law on whether something is an ultimate fact is whether it fits within the legal definition of the ultimate determination. The ultimate determination is whether it's a deceptive act, according to the regulation. It's a deceptive act if these things are met, right?
Correct. So maybe there has to be an act. There has to be some sort of action that's either a lie or an omission or something that is inaccurate. That is a factual question. Whether or not that happened is the first issue. That's the condition precedent. That's the question of evidentiary.
So an inaccuracy.
An inaccuracy, yes, Judge. Okay. You take that inaccuracy, and then you do the analysis for the ultimate issue of fact, or the ultimate conclusion.
Which is whether it's willful, deceptive, and material.
Yes, Judge.
Okay.
Or intentional, but it's the mens rea plus the materiality elements, correct.
Right. So those are the three criteria. I think that's what Judge Terry is saying, that those three criteria render it the ultimate question of fact. Whether the act actually occurred or not, obviously, is a
question of fact.
Okay.
I agree with exactly what you said, Judge, and I believe Judge Terry and I are
on the same page.
The same thing.
It's like that commercial with Geico. I don't know.
Anyway, please proceed, counsel.
Thank you, Judge. After hearing all the evidence, the hearing officers did make specific findings of fact that Officer Nixon was not deceptive, he was not inaccurate, and he did not lie. And as the court has already pointed out, those factual findings, pursuant to the Denver City Charter, as well as Rule 106, as well as established case law, says that the reviewing court has to accept the factual findings of the hearing officer, that they are binding. In this case, the district court did not do that.
Mr. Reynolds, in
yes,
this situation, how does the Halo video come into play? I mean, Judge Starr is obviously relied on that. So can, in your view, based on the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Scott v. Harris or any other factors, can or should a video completely outweigh testimony?
It should not according to the standard under Rule 106 if there's other competent evidence in the record. What Scott says, and it's very specific, it says that the video has to blatantly contradict and utterly discredit the witness's testimony. In this case, there is nothing in that Halo video that utterly discredits or blatantly contradicts Officer Nixon's description of the events. It may call into question what was exactly happening or what his perceptions or perspectives were, but there is nothing in the Halo video that reaches this standard set forth in Scott of utterly discrediting or blatantly contradicting Officer Nixon's statements, which would rise to that level of inaccuracy, as Judge Terry said.
And to the extent that Judge Starr's found that it does blatantly contradict, we are not bound by her observations of the video.
You are not. Under the law, your review is the review of the hearing officer's decision. You're not bound by anything that Judge Starr's found. And I will say this, I wanted to reserve some time, but maybe a minute. Judge Starr, she made two specific factual findings based on her review of that Halo evidence. She said, and this is contrary to witness testimony, Officer Nixon, Officer Dr. Devine, witness Sherelle Thomas, Division Chief Quinones, all said that scene was chaotic. Judge Starr, she watched a video that has no volume, that is incomplete time-wise, and incomplete perspective. It does not show the entire scene. And based on her review of that video, she made the factual finding that the scene wasn't chaotic. That is impermissible fact-finding. The district court has no authority to make any factual findings on a Rule 106 review. Unless there's questions right now by the court, I'd like to reserve my final minute.
Yes, thank you. We have 58 seconds.
Good morning. My name is Carla Pierce, registration number 27881. I'm here today at the table seated with me, co-counsel Jennifer Jacobson. And together we represent the manager of safety in this matter. Your Honors, this was a pretty simple appeal that the hearing officer panel and the commission made a mess of. I mean, something. Officer Nixon and Devine falsely reported the events of July 12, 2009 to cover up their overly aggressive actions, unaware at the time they made those statements that there was a surveillance video that captured every event that subsequently became the subject of the allegations of lying and material omissions.
Ms. Pierce, if I can interrupt you, what is the distinction between saying that they falsely reported on the one hand and what the hearing officers concluded, which was to the effect that people had different perceptions and may have had misrecollections of what had actually occurred?
Well, the falsely reported is what they stated in their reports and then subsequently stated in their interviews with internal investigators as to what exactly happened in the event, in this incident.
But to conclude that someone falsely reported, isn't that requiring an inference of intent on the part of and the individual involved?
It does, and I believe the record supports that they were false.
But in this situation where we're dealing with hearing officers, who has the responsibility for determining whether the statements were either false on the one hand or to symbolize misrecollections on the other?
Well, the panel should have made that determination based on competent evidence.
So if the panel didn't make that determination, was the panel in error or was it within its discretion to make that determination?
It was an error in this case because the panel disregarded or gave very little weight to the video, which directly contradicted not only things that the officer said, but actually contradicted evidentiary findings that the panel made about what happened. And I want to talk about those. The panel found that, for instance, right after Officer Nixon pepper sprayed Ms. Perez in the face, that he was then kicked by Ms. Carrillo and reacted by punching her in the face. Well, the video clearly shows that the punch to Ms. Carrillo happened much later during this incident, and this is...
Much later than what? Than when she kicked him?
I'm sorry. It happened much later than when Nixon pepper sprayed Ms. Perez. After that, he actually engaged in several other activities before coming back to Ms. Carrillo and her kicking him.
But it did happen after she kicked him, or attempted to kick him.
Correct. The point is that it didn't happen right after, in the sequence that the panel found. Ms. Carrillo did not kick Officer Nixon right after he sprayed Ms. Perez. She kicked Officer Nixon much later after he grabbed Ms. Perez by the throat and threw her to the ground. In between that time, he pepper sprayed the crowd. He went into the restaurant, arrested Ms. Thomas, brought her out, and that is when he took Ms. Perez to the ground and Ms. Carrillo kicked him. Why is that important? Because it's the exact sequence of events that the way that Nixon reported it and discussed this with the investigator. He left out a lot of important facts, and the panel simply adopted his misstatement. And they did that more than once. They also omitted from the sequence of events, kept Officer Devine's shoving of Kelly Boyd, which literally lifted her off her feet and caused her to land on her back. The video...
But that's in Devine's report. Is that Nixon's report or Devine's report?
Your Honor, Officer Nixon prepared the use of force reports in this case, and he prepared the lengthy narrative.
So you say he omitted that event?
He did, and he witnessed that event, and he admitted that he witnessed that event, and you can see that he witnessed that event in the video. But he left it out of his statements, he left it out of his report, and then the panel adopted that finding, which is contradicted by the video. The panel also found, as an evidentiary fact, that as Officer Nixon was approaching Sherelle Thomas to place her under arrest, she turned and walked away from him into the restaurant. Again, that's what Nixon reported. The video completely contradicts that. You look at the video, and Officer Nixon is dealing with Anna Perez. He has his back to Sherelle Thomas. He's just maced the crowd. He turns back around to assist Officer Devine with Ms. Perez. And Ms. Thomas, who's bored, and their friends rush into the restaurant to rinse mace off of their face. He's not looking at Sherelle Thomas. He's not facing Sherelle Thomas when she goes in the restaurant, yet he claims she ran away from him.
Counsel, is there any law that says that when you're dealing with concrete evidence like a video, there's no deference that's due to another party's finding of fact regarding that?
Well, I believe that's exactly what Scott versus Harris says, Your Honor. Scott versus Harris says that a lower court, should not accept one party's version of the events when that version is directly contradicted by a video, because that is pure fiction, and that's what happened here.
And let's talk then about what Judge Starrs then did. Why wasn't she required, after determining that the commission was not bound with regard to their ultimate issue of facts, why wasn't she required to remand the matter to the commission to apply the correct standard of law instead of making her own conclusions?
Well, because her role is to review the case to determine whether there's competent evidence in the record then to support the panel's decision.
And if there isn't, what is she supposed to do? Is she just allowed to make her own findings, or isn't she required? Why isn't she required to do a remand?
Well, I believe that all the facts are in the record for her to review, and what she said was, I'm going to disregard any findings that are directly contradicted by the video.
Do you have any law to back up what you're saying, that she's allowed to do that?
Well, I believe the Rule 106 standards state that she's supposed to review the record as a whole and determine whether there's been an abuse of discretion or excess of jurisdiction, and the abuse of discretion says determine whether there's competent evidence in the record to support the underlying decision. She reviewed it, and she looked at what the evidence is that the panel relied on to say that Officer Nixon was not intentionally making false statements and material omissions. And I want to talk about some of that, the evidence that they relied on, because she properly concluded it wasn't competent evidence. The panel justified that decision by saying, well, look, Officer Nixon did accurately report several of his uses of force. That is not competent evidence to prove that he didn't lie, particularly when you consider that three of his six uses of force that he himself used and that he omitted were deemed excessive uses of force. And when you consider that the two uses of force that he reported involved use of mace, which resulted in the citizens having to seek medical treatment, so he clearly couldn't omit that. Nor could he omit his retaliatory punch of Ms. Carrillo, because there were three officers standing right around him at the time. The panel concluded that he didn't lie because he didn't deny taking Ms. Perez to the ground. He just said, I didn't throw her to the ground, and I didn't remember doing that. Well, again, this evidence is really dubious when you consider that he took Ms. Perez to the ground twice. Both were considered to be excessive force, and the first time he did so is what prompted Ms. Carrillo to jump up, and then led to an additional series of uses of force.
Ms. Pierce, didn't Mr. Nixon or Officer Nixon testify at the hearing about the Halo video?
He was walked through the Halo video during the hearing, yes.
So, with regard to these instances that you say that the Halo video completely contradicted what he said, to what extent can the hearing officer, or could the hearing officers, rely on Officer Nixon's explanations of what he saw on the video in comparison to what he actually did?
Well, I think it's evidence that they need to consider. However, we have to consider the fact that some of the lies that he told, they adopted as findings of fact. And you have to consider whether they actually are consistent with the video. And you have to consider whether his testimony was consistent with the versions of events and what he says is an excuse. For instance, Officer Nixon testifies that he omitted the uses of force against Ms. Perez and Ms. Carrillo when he shoved them to the ground, and he omitted Officer Devine's engaging a tug of war with Ms. Thomas and shoving Ms. Boren backwards because those weren't really uses of force. Mind you, three of those uses of force were deemed excessive force. And I don't think any of us sitting here would believe for a moment that those are not uses of force. And yet that's the explanation that he gave for omitting them. They're just daily occurrences. That is simply contradictory evidence. The panel also said, well, even the civilian witnesses got some of the events wrong and remembered them incorrectly. That's not competent evidence to determine whether Officer Nixon was incorrect. First of all, the civilians were all drunk. And Officer Nixon admits that. The civilians are not trained to have to report events that occur right afterwards. They're civilians who came in to a restaurant without thinking, I'm going to have to remember every event that happened here. The officers, Officer Nixon, I believe, had 16 years of experience, are trained that they have to accurately report events as they occur. And the panel also relied heavily on the fact that commanding officers who made recommendations did not think that Officer Nixon lied. Well, that's not competent evidence. That is the opinions of other police officers reviewing the same record that the panel is reviewing. It's not competent evidence. Secondly, those officers have no say in this matter. If you're going to give deference to anyone's opinion, you're required by charter to give deference to the manager of safety, yet they did not. And keep in mind that these commanding officers, three of the four of them, would not have even sustained the excessive force violations. There is a reason that we have civilian oversight of the Denver Police Department, and that's because we felt that the police cannot police themselves and that we should have a civilian in charge of the Department of Safety, and that the hearing officer should give deference to that manager. Which also leads me to the point of how biased this panel was against the manager of safety and how you have to review the determinations they made in that light. I've never read a decision that's so hostile to a decision maker.
Are you saying we need to determine that as a matter of law? Is that even necessary to this appeal?
Well, I'm saying that when you're looking at the evidence that the panel put together and the conclusions they reached, that you should consider that they were not following the proper standard of giving deference to the manager of safety.
Is there any legal significance?
Found to be biased.
Is there any legal significance to that, counsel?
I do believe that it makes their findings arbitrary and capricious because they're not giving the honest and candid consideration to the evidence that a reasonable person would have. They are looking with eyes that are biased against the manager's safety and in favor of the officer. They literally criticized him for judging Officer Nixon's perceptions when that's exactly what his job is to do.
Do you have any legal authority for our determining that it was arbitrary and capricious as a matter of law because they express some biased comments?
No, not that they are as a matter of law. I'm suggesting to the court that you need to look at the record as a whole to determine the competent evidence, and one of the factors that you should consider is the bias that this panel demonstrated against the manager.
But the commission, it's the commission's decision that we're reviewing, not the panel's decision.
Well,
and the commission said the panel shouldn't have given friend who made those comments about the manager's safety. So it seems like it gets washed out somewhere. We're deciding whether the commission properly reviewed the panel's decision. And the judge found that they did not because they gave too much deference to the panel.
Correct.
And isn't that the decision that we also have to make?
Well, you do, but you have to also look at the panel's decision because the commission erroneously concluded that they were bound by all of their findings and didn't actually conduct the proper review.
And if we agree with you that they erroneously found they were bound by it, then that's all, isn't that all that we have to say in this case?
No, I'm sorry, I didn't.
If we agree with your conclusion or your argument that the commission erroneously concluded they were bound by the panel, don't we have to just send this case back to the commission and have them apply the proper standard with respect to ultimate findings of fact?
I just,
Terry asked a question about 15 minutes ago.
I don't believe that you do. I believe that this court has the ability to review the record and, as the district court did, disregard the evidence that that contradicts the video and determine whether then there was competent evidence to support the panel's conclusion. And I believe when you do that, you will be compelled to conclude, as the district court did, that there was no competent evidence.
Thank you, counsel. Your time has expired, and Bailiff, I'm going to ask you to add 2.5 minutes to the rebuttal time for counsel for the appellant. Thank you.
Judge Tubman, to answer your question, yes, Officer Nixon testified at trial in great detail about the Halo video. He was examined on direct and he was cross-examined by the city attorneys on that issue. Not only did Officer Nixon describe the Halo video, every other witness from the incident who testified or who was available or called to trial was walked through that same video and described to the three hearing officers their perceptions of what the events were at the time. And it's important to note there that every single one of those witnesses, every single contemporaneous witness, made some testimonial inaccuracy. For instance, every single witness for the city who testified that it wasn't Officer Nixon who pepper sprayed the crowd. It was actually Officer Devine. Now, we know from looking at the Halo video that that's not accurate. That is untrue. And at hearing, every single one of those witnesses was asked, well, when you reported that it was Officer Devine who sprayed the crowd, were you intentionally lying to the commission, to these hearing officers? And across the board, the answer was no. Across the board, every single witness said, you're right, when I review the Halo video, I realize that I was wrong when I said that Officer Devine sprayed the crowd. But I wasn't lying. I was trying to tell you to the best of my recollection. At the hearing, witnesses for the city were asked, well, does a failure of a recollection rise to the level of deceptive conduct? And the answer was unequivocal. No, it does not. People can have differing recollections, differing memories about the exact same events.
That's the way of trials constantly in our courts, isn't it?
It is. And I'm not sure if Your Honor is familiar with eyewitness testimony, for instance, but it is notoriously inaccurate. And that does not change what the person, what the witness perceived. Simply because his recollection is not 100% consistent with the videotape does not in any way prove that that witness is lying or being deceptive. There was a statement that was admitted into evidence at trial, and I asked the city's witnesses if they agreed with this statement. Quote, statements of witnesses to the same event can and often do vary. They may be inconsistent with other witness statements and the physical evidence, even with a video of the events. This does not necessarily mean the witness is lying or departing from the truth. This case is an example of that fact. When you accuse someone of lying or departing from the truth, you have, at a minimum, a moral and ethical duty to be right and to be able to prove it. If you make such accusations from a position of responsibility and authority, abuse of this power can lead to irreparable harm to the system. That was a quote by Denver District Attorney Mitch Morrissey regarding a police case where a police officer believed he saw a gun in the hands of the suspect and believed that the suspect took some sort of furtive action, and the officer ended up shooting the suspect.
Thank you, counsel. Your time now has expired.
Oh, thank you, Judge. I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
We appreciate the arguments and the briefing of both counsel. Thank you very much for them. The case will now stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. That concludes our docket for today, for this morning anyway, and the court may stand in recess, and the bailiff may so announce.